Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast episode 438. What do they do next? Part 15A, Bill Bruford.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 438 of the Yes Music Podcast, Two Fans' Exploration of the World's Greatest Progressive Rock Band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, in our second part of What Bill Did Next, Mark and I enjoy listening to the Earthworks album Stamping Ground. It's a complete change for me, but Mark has quite a few Earthwork albums already. Listen out for our comments on that later. Around the social webs this week, and specifically on the YMP Facebook page, Simon Barrow spotted the subject of this week's episode in a rare performance during lockdown. It's a video of a composition by all sorts of other home-based musicians, and it's called People Need People. The author of the words, creative writing professor Benjamin Zephaniah, appears, and it's really worth watching. I received, at last, my own copy of Rick Wakeman's The Red Planet, and the packaging is just as good as the music, which is to say, wonderful. Mark wished everyone a happy 4th of July, and Simon Barrow was back, announcing what he's currently doing. He says, "Talking of publishing projects, I have several in hand, ranging from Scotland after the virus, with Luath Press, through to a collection of my theological writings from journals and books over the years. And my book on the music of Yes, Cultured Lama, in 2018, has an associated webpage which now has a dozen articles on it. Head over to yessolidmentalgrace.com for more on all that. I uploaded the full Union art print as a new cover photo. Do you remember that you need to get in quickly to make sure you can have one of these fantastic YMP items? Go to yesmusicpodcast.com/shop to pick one up, as well as to pre-order your copy of the YMP Yes Trivia Card Game. If you've been putting it off, make sure this week is the week that you do it. Another YMP listener and patron, Stephen Lamb, has created the third edition of his great book, Yes, Every Album, Every Song, which now includes the latest Yes album from a page, as well as other updates. Burningshed.com has copies of that. Uncle Preston Frazier has reached Hour of Need from Fly From Here in his epic review series, and in the visitor post this week, Jeffrey Mason added the following slew of Yes-related posts. A slightly odd post from someone called Sean Manchester, who seems annoyed that Steve Howe has airbrushed him out of his autobiography. Rick Wakeman's terrible magic trick video to publicise The Red Planet. Billy Sherwood talking about the new Days Between Stations album, Giants. Steve Howe on the progressiveaspect.net, a new John Anderson interview. Excellent photographs from Yes playing in Berkeley Community Theatre on the 5th of August 1972. And Neil Morse talking about his forthcoming cover version of No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed, which features John Davison. Dave Watkinson was on Talk Radio Europe discussing his John Anderson and the Warriors book and record, and recent Yes live partner on the Royal Affair tour, John Lodge, has released a new single called In These Crazy Times, brackets isolation mix, featuring vocals from John Davison. Here's a bit of the press release. It says, John recorded the tracks in his home studio in Florida, and he performed vocals and guitar, and using GarageBand, keyboards and drums. Joining John on the song are his wife, Kirsten, and son, Christian, both of whom have never recorded before. John was also delighted to have John Davison of Yes add backing vocals and harmonies. John says, in 1967, the Moody Blues recorded Days of Future Past, and we were in the studio in lockdown 24 hours a day, creating an album that changed my life. Being in lockdown now reminds me of the creativity and solitude that took place during that period of my life. So I've taken the opportunity, given by this lockdown period, to write and record a new song about these difficult days. Days that stretched into weeks and months. Over on Twitter, Brian Neeson added to the mystique around a certain early Yes bass duet. He points out that it was only played a total of 3 times. And I wonder if those were the only other times, apart from the Chris and Billy Sherwood instances, when 2 bass players performed together in a Yes concert. Let me know if you can think of any other times. Henry Potts broke the news that Sherwood and Kay will soon be starting work on a new Circa album, and Tom Brislin has re-released Spiralling's Transmitter album, which contains one of my favourite songs of all time, Lightning Twice. The mighty Miguel Falcao has revamped his very different and surprising Onward bass cover from Tomato. And finally, for now, do take a look at the comments on the show notes for the first part of this Bill Bruford episode for great additions by Simon Barrow and Jeffrey Mason. So many thanks indeed to everyone who got in touch in any way this week. Before my own thoughts on Stamping Ground, here's Michael Handerhan's first-hand recollections.
Hey guys, this is Michael Handerhan. I just wanted to give you my thoughts on the Bill Bruford's Earthworks tour. I happened to see them back in 1992. I was at the State College Ballroom at Mansfield University in Mansfield, Pennsylvania, and that was on March 16th, only 11 days after the Union tour. That's a free show. A very intimate place. It was between 100 and 200 people there. I saw four very talented musicians. Most memorable for me is the sounds that Bill Bruford produced from his electronic drum kit. Sounds like Up North and All Heaven Broke Loose exemplify this for me. They were in great form that night. Of course, like it's traditional in jazz, you can hear the audience clap at the end of a solo that was played during the various songs. It's amazing. That was my first jazz show, and it just automatically comes to you to clap like that. It's just an amazing thing. It was a free show. There were no tickets, no program, no brochure, no table to buy any products, not even a poster or pamphlet I can swipe off the wall after the show. So I really have no souvenirs from it, just the memory of the music and the Yes Magazine postcard that I got in the mail at letting you know about the show. One thing I wanted to comment on especially was that Dr. Bill just got off the Union tour, I guess 5 days or so before he started touring again with Earthworks. And I know at the Union, at the end of the Union tours, he just walk off the stage and roadies would, you know, pick up his drum kit and tuck it away. But here we are, he's on the Earthworks tour. After the show, I was chatting with a few people, and then when I was leaving, I happened to glance over, and there was the band. They were just finishing up, loading up a small rental-sized truck that they had. And this kind of made me realize the 180 that Dr. Bill did. He, you know, went from those large venues and roadies putting his kit away, and here he is just traveling the back roads of Pennsylvania and, you know, putting his equipment away himself and, you know, with the other band members. So just an interesting little thing. Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys. Oh, and I received that Food Union print poster. Wonderful piece of artwork. I always love those things, that type of artwork. Doesn't look anywhere near person, but you still know who it is. Okay, take care, guys.
Thanks very much for that, Michael. How wonderful that you were there at this historic event just after the Union tour. I have to admit to a feeling of unease when I approach this record. As I've said before, I have little to no understanding or experience of jazz, so I'm expecting to be completely out of my depth. The personnel on Bill Bruford's Earthworks Live Stamping Ground are Bill Bruford, acoustic and electronic drums and percussion, Tim Harries, acoustic and fretless bass, Ian Bellamy, soprano, alto and tenor saxophones, Django Bates, keyboards, tenor horn and trumpet. The first piece is called Nerve, and it's written by Ian Bellamy. So here we go. It opens with sci-fi sounds. I have no idea whether those are created by the electronic drums or not. Then the whole band enters, with fast drumming in an exciting and complex fashion underpinning everything. Sax and guitar play in unison, and the bass adds sometimes disjointed and sometimes running lines. It's a fascinating oral landscape and includes little chordal sections from time to time, which I recognise as jazz colours, but the motion is so fast and the change is so frenetic, I can't really keep up. Suddenly there's a hiatus, and then we hit the road again. A change in mood, hits, and lots of exploratory sounds emanate from the keys, in an unsettling and apparently random manner, accompanied by fragmented jots and explosions from the other instruments. The production and recording are superb, but I'm finding it very challenging to keep up with what's going on. There doesn't seem to be a great deal to grab hold of. The music slips through my listening fingers before I can latch on. It's endlessly interesting, though, but I don't know if it's good jazz, and I don't know if I am enjoying it. Finally, Bruford leads the band into a madcap ending, and the crowd seems to have enjoyed it anyway. The second piece is a Bruford and Bellamy composition called Up North, presumably not followed by Where It's Boring and Slow. I have personal proof that that isn't the case anyway. This begins with some drumming, which is definitely of the Bruford melody electronic variety. It works rather well, and the tone of the instrument blends well with saxophone and horn and bass. This is a much more catchy number with a repeated tune and some fine soloing, very laid back and dreamy. The synth drums disappear and Bruford returns to a full acoustic kit. The music develops with dramatic and delightful saxophone soloing, and is much more enjoyable to my uncultured ears than the opening piece on the album. The crowd applaud, so I suppose that's the end of the saxophone solo spot. That's what they do in jazz, isn't it? The horn has a go next, and the electronic percussion returns. Upbeat now and immersive, a great and enjoyable little piece which ends with a bit of a musical joke. Then we move on to A Stone's Throw by Bellamy, Bates and Bruford. Trilled saxophone notes vie with assorted percussion in an enigmatic opening, and it sounds more like experimental classical music to me than jazz. A bit John Cage-prepared piano, a style which I very much like, incidentally. There follows a quiet and tender saxophone solo passage with gentle bass and piano accompaniment. It's lovely music, with such a restful feel. Eventually, Bruford re-enters, and the mood moves on to more of a steady, walking tempo, with saxophone soloing above, occasionally emitting low and strident notes. I find this music very relaxing. The piano takes over the lead with fast runs and patterns, and the whole piece shifts up another gear. I find myself nodding my head in sympathy with the infectious beat. I can't pretend to understand what the piano is doing, but I wonder if I really need to. The overall effect is very pleasant indeed. Again, the crowd react very positively to the piano as the saxophone takes over again, and Bruford rolls around the kit to encourage the band to move towards the ending passage, which features an interesting, fast, fluctuating synth percussion texture. Pilgrim's Way is written by Bruford alone. At the start, he employs more drum-triggered melodic elements which work rather nicely in a synth manner in this context. After some exploration of the sounds, he sets up a subtle groove for the saxophone to play a wistful tune above. There's a slight metallic edge to the percussion, but it's not too noticeable. Bass creeps in and it's a very peaceful soundscape, as it plays sometimes in unison with, and sometimes in a complementary fashion. The percussion and bass continue, and a synthesized sounding instrument takes over the lead. Is it a keyboard of some kind? I don't know, but it adds to the intriguing soundscape, which is unlike anything I can think of. I like it. Saxophone now takes up the melody, and some nicely crafted answering phrases are passed between it and the bass. It's a very interesting piece, which finishes with what sounds like Indian tabla to me. Triggered from Bruford's kit? I don't know, but the fact that this tapestry of wonder has been created live is remarkable. Next is a Bates piece, the oddly titled Emotional Shirt. This sounds industrial to begin with. Maybe Bruford had been back to the scrapyard Alan White visited during the Relayer sessions. No, I don't think so. It's a fragmented set of rhythms between drums, saxophone and bass. Once again, it's very interesting indeed, and the almost constant slight changes keep you listening carefully. There's a bit in the middle which sounds like a science fiction soundtrack to a film about an alien creature popping its head out from behind a Martian rock formation, or something like that. It proceeds to get more and more complex and seemingly random, or at least the accompaniment does. The saxophone suddenly plays a very recognisable theme before piano takes us off into quasi King Crimson cat food territory. The virtuosity is astounding. I have no idea how much of this is improvised and how much is planned, but whatever the case, it's brimming with energy and fun. Little duets appear between synth and real instruments, and then an abrupt end shocks the system. It Needn't End in Tears is by Bellamy. It's a beautifully quiet piece with tender sax soloing to start. The melodic twists and turns are fascinating and use pretty much the whole range of the instrument. You can float away to a nighttime scene by a waterfront, maybe. Then drums and bass come in, followed by piano, and the music moves on, with a beat slow and relaxed, with the saxophone leading the way. The cigarette smoke is almost visible in the dark jazz club of the mind's eye, as the music envelops the listener like an enormous fluffy duvet. The piano solo has more motion, but it's still beautifully laid back. Perfect music for relaxing to, but still with plenty to interest the careful listener. After a sax workout, the tune reappears and we're reminded what a lovely one it is, ending with a dramatic hiatus and a definitive close. Bill Bruford announces Bellamy as the composer and the crowd are suitably impressed. I'm surprised and very impressed with the variety of music on this album. It must have been a wonderful event to be present at. All Heaven Broke Loose, a Bellamy Bates Bruford composition, is split into one psalm, two old song, which is clearly reminiscent of the movements in prog songs, but you'll have to let me know if that's a common practice in jazz as well. It sounds to me like Bruford is back at the Simmons drums for the opening of this piece, but I could be wrong. It's soft and undulating accompaniment to some more lovely saxophone soloing. The mood lifts a little with the addition of bass and more of a pulse, but the overall impression is of perhaps a stream flowing gently. The melodic sax line finally settles into a recognisable melody for a moment, and the pulse becomes more insistent and bold. The key focus shifts, and the music builds into much more of a playful party place, with the jaunty piano chords and some chaotic moments with all instruments trying to outdo each other with their frenetic and seemingly fairly random playing. A big theme appears, which I imagine is meant to be the old song, and it does indeed sound very vocally based as the saxophone and bass present it with remarkable tom fills from Bruford. A very rewarding listen and a great ending. Bates is responsible for the next piece, Candles Still Flicker in Romania's Dark. Another interesting title. More Simmons sounds open this one, with a horn solo over the top. It's a beautifully mellow combination, with an almost imperceptible pulse. The tenor horn, I think, adds interesting effects, and I have to say I've never heard an instrument like this played in this way. Bass adds a quiet line, as does the saxophone, and this is a good example of how Bruford has managed to keep some chordal aspects to the song with his electronic percussion, where there aren't any keyboards or piano. It's very carefully integrated here, and I think it works remarkably well. Little passages of piano come in, as well as some acoustic drums in a different kind of section, but the overall mood is a calm one. In fact, there are even moments of absolute silence. A peak of volume is only brief, and it's another engrossing piece with some lovely bass soloing to bring the piece to an unexpected, normal chord finish. Finally, we reach Bridge of Inhibition by Bellamy, Bates and Bruford. A rough and ready blast of an opening is followed by some rather metallic-sounding electronic drums, the only moment so far when I haven't liked the sounds. A vaguely Eastern-sounding unison passage then appears before a walking bass part and ride cymbal accompaniment support a rapidly moving alto sax solo. There's great forward motion and interjections of that Eastern-sounding material again, and then the tenor horn has a go at a solo, which is in the same ferociously fast mode. I can't say I fully understand how the solos are constructed, but they are very enjoyable to my ears with occasional fragments of recognisable motifs. Bruford adds some blistering acoustic drumming, and then the bass is left on its own to try out a few variations. The tone of the bass is lovely here, and despite Tim Harris not contributing to any of the composition, he fulfils Simon Barrow's assessment of his prowess. It's an amazing passage. Bill has a solo next, which is acoustic and brilliant, with stunning rolls around the kit, intricate patterns using every aspect of the instrument, while still keeping the perfectly metered pulse going. An absolute masterclass of drumming, incorporating all sorts of jazz and other styles of percussive delight. I was wondering if the electronics would make an appearance, and they do, but integrated well into the solo, so the melodic aspects are complementary rather than off-putting. The original material from the opening is repeated in a very dramatic finish, resulting in rapturous applause from the crowd. So, what to say about this album? Well, as I mentioned above, it's a lot more varied than I was expecting. I think the electronic percussion works well almost the whole way through, and the instrumental performances are stunning. The production and sound quality are excellent for a live album, and after my initial reluctance when listening to the first piece, I've really enjoyed expanding my musical experience by listening carefully to Earthworks. You'll have to let me know if this album is representative of the output of the band, and it may well not be the best introduction to either the genre or Bruford's output, but it certainly encouraged me to find out more about the band.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are back to talking about Mr. Bill Bruford in our second part of the What Did They Do Next series. So the album that we're taking a look at, as we mentioned in the first part, is Stamping Ground. A couple of interesting things about this record. Before I start talking about it, let's just do a little bit of a recap. This was released in 1994. It was recorded on March 14th, 1992, and May 22nd, 1992. The first date was in New York, and the second date was in Boston. So obviously this is a live album. It was produced by Bill Bruford and Derek Drescher, and it was released on Bill Bruford's own Summerfold Records. Now, that's what's on here for the wiki. I'm not 100% certain, or I can't remember, if it was released on a different label beforehand. Maybe it's possible it was on EG, the same label that he released some of his earlier albums, which is tied to King Crimson. Now, the interesting thing about this time period, if you look at the dates of when this was recorded, this was really close to after he left Yes from the, well, after the Union tour was done. He had pretty much run back and started doing his Earthworks thing again, which makes me wonder if, you know, he was really itching to get back to this type of music near the end of the Yes cycle. And, you know, he wanted to get it out of his system because it seemed like he was very prepared to go forward with this. Now, what's very interesting about this record is the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, in the beginning of Earthworks, Bill Bruford used a lot of electronic drums and decided that instead of being more of the rhythmical part of the band, that he would provide more of the melodic end of things. By the time he gets to this point in his career, and as I realized listening to this album, because in the prior part I had mentioned that I remembered electronic drums for some reason in this, and much to my surprise re-listening to this record, there is not much electronic drums at all on this record. In fact, Bill Bruford reverts back to a very acoustic setting, which is not a surprise at all considering how much trouble he had with the electronic drums on the Union tour. In fact, he had so much trouble with it, it totally conked out on him in the show in Madison Square Gardens, leaving him with just a snare drum and cymbals. So I'm guessing that after that kind of an experience, one's love of the electronic drums dwindles a bit after that. Another thing that I found very interesting about this whole Earthworks period is something that he also wrote in his biography, that while he was very happy to be back playing the music that he loved and the music that he wrote, and being the, you know, the band leader and everything, he quickly realized that it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be, having to go to play smaller venues, having to set up the drums himself many times, sometimes having, you know, things go wrong, parts breaking, having to go himself and grab parts. It just seemed like a complete nightmare, the way he sometimes put it, doing this whole Earthworks tour himself, being the man in charge of everything, being the manager as well, sort of deal. It just seems that it was not as glorious as he thought it was. And I think that my theory might be right, because when the opportunity came around to join King Crimson again in the late 90s, he jumped at the opportunity. And I remember in his biography him saying that he kind of smiled when he was back at nicer hotels, playing bigger venues, having a roadie come out to set up his stuff for him. It was a nice change from having to do everything himself. So I think he might look back at his Earthworks time as a love-hate sort of thing. But back to this album. There's many great songs on this record, particularly the songs that I really enjoyed was, you know, Candle Still Flickering in Romania's Dark is excellent. Emotional Shirt is good. Up North is fantastic. But of course, to me, the big song of interest is Bridge of Inhibition. Now, the thing I find interesting about this version of it is because it was recorded on the first album. This is when he was using his electronic drums and using them in that more melodic role that I had mentioned on the prior episode. And now, when they do it live in this version of the song, he has obviously put all those sort of sampled parts that he would do over onto the horn section and let them be the more dominant end of it. I mean, obviously they did their own parts of it as well, but now he just seems to be focusing more back on a strict sort of acoustical drumming performance of this song. And it sounds good. I mean, honestly, listening back to the original version of it, while the original version definitely sounds a little bit more original and a little bit more interesting as far as originality goes, I think that Bill is much more comfortable playing these songs in a more straight-ahead jazz setup, let's just put it that way. They still come across very strong, don't get me wrong, and it doesn't sound dated. It doesn't sound like an old song, I think, because of that. If he would have brought out the old Simmons drums on this tour and performed it that way, I think it might have made it sound a little dated. I think this way, performing it this way, gave it a little bit more modernized touch, I would say. And I think that goes for the other songs as well on this record that he played from this first album. Songs like Up North and Emotional Shirt. I mean, obviously those again had the sort of electronic drum treatment with it and now are played in a more straight ahead drum style. Now, of course, it'd be a crime not to mention the fact that in Bridge of Inhibition, Bill does a drum solo. I think anybody who goes to see a concert with Bill Bruford in it keeps their fingers crossed that Bill Bruford comes out and does a drum solo. And a drum solo he does, and a fantastic one, and one that sounds definitely more comfortable behind an acoustic set than it probably would have sounded behind an electronic set. By this point, I think if he would have done a drum solo behind the Simmons kit, he probably would have had to take the rosary out, a few sets of Hail Marys, and hope that it wouldn't conk out on him halfway through it. So I think that, again, going back to this acoustic set was the right choice for Bill to do at this point. Now, it would be a crime not to mention the rest of the band, as they played very well on this recording. Again, some fantastic performances, and that coming from me, who is not very big into the whole jazz scene. I really enjoyed this stuff. I don't know if it's just because of Bill's involvement. You know, it's one of those things maybe that because I love Yes so much, then immediately having him in a band like this might give me a slightly different approach to listening to this than if he wasn't in this band. If it was just a band of random musicians, would I give it as much of a chance? Who knows? But because Bill's in it, I gave it that time, I think, that I needed to get into it. And I'm glad I did, because it's a great record. And again, like I said, the people involved in it, like Tim Harries, who plays acoustic bass and fretless bass, does a fantastic job. And of course, the main stars of the show, in my opinion, besides Bill, is Ian Bellamy on the soprano, alto, and tenor saxophones, and Django Bates on keyboards, tenor, horn, and trumpet. The horn playing on this album is just fantastic. I mean, everything about it is just so well done. Their harmonization, the way that they play off each other. There's a few interesting duets that they do sometimes. It's just so well done and well structured. And the fact that a lot of these songs have members of the band writing as well. Emotional Shirt was written by Bates as well. Bellamy was involved in Bridge of Inhibition. Bates wrote Candles Still Flickering in Romania's Dark, which is a great song, as I mentioned before. But Bill Bruford, of course, has a lot of writing in this as well. Up North, he's involved with. Pilgrim's Way is his own written song. So it is very much a band situation in this. And I think that made it all the stronger for the material that was written and performed. So it's a good record. It's not a record I pull out very often. I mean, even the first Earthwork album that I have on vinyl, I don't listen to it too often. Every once in a while when I'm in the mood for it, I will pull it out and listen to it. But that's not to say that this isn't a well-performed album, and people who like this type of jazz-influenced music would definitely enjoy this. So I give it a thumbs up, and let's go over to Kevin and talk about it further.
So I'm here now with Mark to discuss this very different album of very different music. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. And you?
Oh, very good. We're going through a rather strong heat wave here, so I'm trying to keep in shelter and keep cool.
Another direct comparison to the UK then, where it is absolutely tipping it down with rain and has been for 2 days now. But never mind.
Wow.
Okay, so Bill Bruford, Earthworks, and this live album. And we've said this many times about other members of Yes and what they've done outside the group. You can always tell it's Bill, can't you? So as soon as you put this record on, you know that there are some electronic sounds, as we've discussed, and we'll come back to in a minute, but certainly when he's doing his acoustic work, you definitely know that's Bill, don't you?
Oh yeah, I mean, he definitely has a style of his own, and it's interesting because out of all the instruments that, you know, we hear when we're listening to Yes music, I think the drums are probably the most difficult one to have a sort of stamp on, because it's such a, you know, it's an instrument that sounds relatively the same with, you know, many different drummers, but Bill seems to make a sound of his own when he plays on drums.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did recognize a few elements, particularly from Yes and Time and a Word in there, you know, the jazzier elements that Bill brought himself. Did you notice anything that you particularly recognized?
I didn't notice anything specific, but I did notice, you know, a lot of kind of signature sort of kind of fills that he likes to do, and kind of different snare rolls and stuff like that. And the way he accents stuff is very Bill-ish, especially when we get to the one song where he has his actual drum solo. There's very much moments of Yes in there. Makes me think back to Sounding Out, that BBC documentary they had back then, when they showed Bill doing his drum solo then.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Well, definitely can hear him immediately. And actually, also, I mean, I don't know how many people over the years have actually used that Simmons kit, but he, as you said, he doesn't use it an enormous amount on this live record, but he does use it a bit. And when he does bring it in, you can definitely hear that it's that kit, can't you? I mean, that must be the sound. So at this point in electronic percussion, it doesn't seem that it was very easy to use, you know, sounds from everywhere, sounds that are sampled in, or certainly Bill doesn't seem to, because when you hear those sounds, you recognise them from the Union Live solo spot that he did with Alan, and also from ABWH and the other times that you've heard them. It's a very characteristic sound of that particular kit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting that how Bill kind of stayed with some of these signature sounds that became very apparent to him. Like he said, ABWH and, you know, the Union tour and stuff like that, there were sounds that reoccur on this. But it is interesting, though, that you bring this up, because this is in the 90s already, right, when this came out, or when they recorded. You know, they recorded in 1992. So I remember Neil Peart, for example, he was using a lot of electronic stuff for Power Windows and for Hold Your Fire, which was like late 80s. And he had gone the way of sampling a lot of different things, African instruments and all kinds of other things. So I'm guessing that maybe either he just didn't have the interest in finding other things to sample, or maybe he was just content with the sounds that he had and felt that he didn't completely explore them as far as he wanted to.
Yeah, and I liked the way that he, you know, set up some grooves. I don't know if he had the technology to set up a particular pattern with the pads and then play it on a loop, but he may have done. And certainly I think it's integrated a lot better into this than, for example, ABWH, which was, as you say, only a few years before, but perhaps the technology had moved on even from there. So what I wanted to ask you, though, about this album, it's a live album, so they were playing music from different Earthworks albums. Do you see the selection of songs, sorry, not songs, pieces, the selection of pieces on this live album to be a good sort of sampler of what Earthworks had done to date?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was interested by the amount of songs that he took from the first record, mainly because there was a lot of more use of the electronic stuff there. As I mentioned, I found that on this live record, he had gone back more to the acoustic side of things, probably because he's just more comfortable with it. Let's just be honest, right? I think that's where he feels more at home. But, you know, songs like Up North, for example, that's a very clear example of him using those Simmons pads as more of the melodic part of it, that whole din, 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 din at the beginning. It's very much a line that you could have heard played on a guitar or even on a piano, right? And he just played it on the drums instead, right? I mean, there are songs that are off this first album. You know, Bridge of Inhibition is off the first record. I think he has a good cross-section of songs from different records.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that that beginning of Up North, really characteristic. And also, it did put me in mind of some of that 80s King Crimson stuff, Discipline and Three of a Perfect Pair. And actually, you can hear that when you hear Up North, the beginning of Up North, I heard a lot of the basis of some of those songs around that era of King Crimson, which I hadn't realised were down to what Bill Bruford was doing. So again, he shows himself to be really interested in adding those melodies through percussion and, you know, making it a signature of King Crimson at that time as well. But yeah, going back to the selection that we've got here on this album, there are some radically different sounding pieces. And I was actually very surprised and very pleased, as I said in my piece, about that. So from what I'd call, although I really don't know what I'm talking about, more traditional sounding jazz pieces to something like Emotional Shirt, which is a bizarre name to call a piece of music, and also quite a different kind of music on that. So very much more sort of industrial sounding and going for a different soundscape altogether. I think that's a real strength of this record.
Yeah, definitely. You know, again, Emotional Shirt being off the first record where he was very much exploring that end of the Simmons drums. But, you know, you made a really excellent point about the King Crimson thing, because if you listen to a record like Three of a Perfect Pair, that album is structured in such a way that one side of it is more geared towards commercialized songs and then the other side is total experimental, even bordering on industrial music. Like I believe there's a song there called Dig or Industry or something like that, and they're very much of those kind of sounds that have, like, you know, almost like hitting steel pipes or stuff like that. Like it's very much like that. And you know, King Crimson was definitely a time period where he explored this as well, right? Yeah. He also used more traditional stuff as well. Like he did use like an Indian kind of, not Indian, like an African kind of box where he hid.
Yes.
And I forget the name of the song. It's the last song on the first side on Discipline, but people are going to yell at me that I forgot this. But it's like a do-do-do-do-do-do-do. He does like this melody throughout the whole song.
And there's a great video of that as well, yes. I can picture him in my mind's eye playing that instrument.
And even Waiting Man off of the second record, Beat. He has this kind of thing that he does in the Simmons drums. So, you know, it's interesting. The Simmons drums and Bill Bruford have this sort of love-hate connection that he has throughout his whole career. So even though he does mock it a lot in his biography, in his book, how he said how it conked out on him in the middle of one of his most important gigs.
Yes.
But yet he still went back to it.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? And when I mentioned it to him, I asked him a slightly mischievous question at the unveiling of the plaque back in 2018. And I asked him if he ever regretted actually using the electronic stuff. And he absolutely said no, he didn't regret anything that he'd done in his career. In fact, I think I remember him saying. So that's nice to hear.
Good.
Yeah. And one other thing that's nice about this album, though, is the production and the recording. It's really fantastic, isn't it? I mean, when we've complained about live albums in the past, and we have complained about some, that's for sure, this one seems to handle the crowd noise and the clean separation of the instruments extraordinarily well. I think it sounds like an amazing production.
Yeah, I think it's easily one of the better live albums I've heard, and I think that goes down to the fact that, number one, I think that he wasn't playing in exactly the largest of venues at this time in his career. Because of the fact that they don't have a vocalist in this band.
So all the
microphones that are up on stage are just left open and set correctly for those particular instruments. They don't have to worry about somebody taking a microphone in hand and walking around and, you know, pointing it to an audience or accidentally pointing it down at the monitor and having it squawk back and stuff. So they have the perfect situation to pick up the sounds as you know, as perfectly as possible. And I think it really, really shows that way. I mean that's one of the advantages also of the electronic kit.
Yeah.
Is that because you take a DI signal from it, there's just nothing that's going to get in the way of that sound unless just, you know, your DI box conks out or something. But other than that, you have a very clean, strong signal from that brain unit and you can record it perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other musicians then. And the thing which astounded me, and I did have a look at some videos of Earthworks so that I could see exactly what was going on. And it made a lot more sense to me, actually, when I did watch the videos of some of the pieces that we heard on this record. The horn playing, now I've never seen, is it an English horn? Is that how it's described on this?
Yeah.
I've never seen a horn played like that in my life before. It's absolutely amazing to see an instrument which traditionally in British sort of brass bands and so on is very much in the background. It's an accompaniment type piece, certainly in the music that I've been exposed to. But seeing that playing solos is just astonishing.
Yeah, it was definitely an instrument that I didn't expect to hear in that circumstance. But again, that's one of the things that makes this kind of a band fantastic, is to expect the unexpected. I mean, Ian Bellamy, I believe is his name.
Yeah.
Just a fantastic saxophone player, you know, and even that, and even Django Bates there, he does some great tenor, horn, and trumpet stuff. It's just the way that they play off of each other, and even the way they harmonize sometimes together is just brilliant. I just absolutely love it. I mean, I was never a big saxophone person. I don't mind trumpet, and I don't mind, you know, trombone. I think trombone maybe only because in, you know, elementary school and high school, I had to play trombone, unfortunately. Oh, right. So I guess maybe I got a little small connection to it that way, but I was never a big sax player, like loving of that instrument. Yeah. But in this situation, I really liked the way they do it, because I always thought that saxophone was a really harsh instrument. You know, I always think back to like Huey Lewis and the News and all these, you know, like Bruce Springsteen or something, where it's less just like blasting saxophone, but they can make it really subtle and really nice in these kind of situations.
Yeah, yeah, isn't that nice? And it's put me in mind of the amazing saxophone Yes album that I've got, which is called A Sax Life Plays Yes, Total Sax Retain. And I reviewed this years and years and years ago, and an amazing saxophonist by the name of Jameson Smeltz. I hope I've pronounced that right, Jameson. But yeah, I absolutely love that. If you can possibly find that, and I was sent that several years ago, you can go back through the episodes and find my review of that. Really fantastic stuff. So we have Heaven and Turn of the Century and all sorts of things on there, and You and I, the big medley, arranged, performed, produced, recorded, mixed, and conceived by Jameson Smeltz. So, yes, absolutely. So saxophone certainly can be. And that's interesting, that, because clarinet, which is, you know, quite similar to a saxophone in some ways, has the same sort of, and some of those other instruments, wind instruments like oboes as well, when people first start learning them and playing them, you're right, it's always loud, it's always brash, it's always harsh. Mm. And it's only when you get into the nuances and the proper technique and so on where you can make it really sing and speak beautifully, softly. And that really is something which came out again from this record, is the dramatic variation that you have in this record, and some beautiful, haunting, pastoral stuff, and also that metallic contrasting stuff as well. So really, really excellent. Oh, and the other thing I was going to say was I watched a video of this lineup playing the Up North, and I also watched a saxophonist playing it, so not a horn player at all. And I have to say I prefer the horn version. Yeah, I was fascinated by what you said about the comparison and how Bill was a bit, I suppose, disappointed and upset that the smaller venues and how much work he had to do, and it really was all down to him. So if you imagine him being in the union set up with that vast tour that they did, and all the people they had working for them, and the nice hotels and so on, whereas with Earthworks, it was pretty much his baby, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I found extremely interesting in his book. I mean, if anybody out there hasn't gotten this book, I highly recommend it, because there's some fantastic stories, especially if you're a musician. You'll find some of this enlightening, because especially about that, like, you know, here he is going on a huge tour, you know, money, you know, supporting the band like crazy, nice hotels, good food, you know, you don't have to do anything except show up and play. And then you go from that to, like, you know, getting phone calls at all hours of the day and night for, you know, what's going on here? Where is this? When are you guys going to come up? Can you do an interview now and this and that? And, like, he's in charge of everything.
Yeah.
And I remember a part in the book where he said that they had something go wrong while he was setting up his drums. Something was wrong with his hi-hat clutch or something. Mm. And he had to literally try to hunt down a part, you know, and tell some guy that was working at the club, can you go to this music store and pick up this piece? You know what I mean? It's just like stuff that you just don't want to do when you're Bill Bruford and at this level of, you know, of your career. You don't want this to be doing this kind of stuff. So I think that when Mr. Fripp came knocking later on to do the Thrack record, I think that he probably jumped at the chance to go back and do that.
Now, you see, I have a terrible confession to make about Thrack and that era of King Crimson. I've not heard any of that music, so that's another gap that I'm going to have to to fill in.
You really must listen to it.
So we'll have to come. We'll have to find a way of building that into the episodes as well. Yes. So yes, it's just reminded me of some of the stories from the earliest part of Bill's autobiography and also Steve's as well, where they were in the back of a van going from gig to gig and, you know, very much doing everything for themselves as well. So funny to come full circle to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. So I have very much enjoyed that. I was, as I said in my piece, slightly worried when I first heard the first song and it didn't really connect with me for some reason. But then the rest of the album really, really did. I really very much enjoyed listening to that. And it's great to listen to something completely different for a change. So I know that you listening out there have a lot more information and a lot more opinions about Earthworks, Bill Bruford, and this era of his music. So do please leave them on the show notes for this week. Thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulrine and Mark Anthony Kay.
Just before we go, here's half of the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol Bags, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, and William Hayes. Continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in helping the lights stay on here at YMP Towers, then just go over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details, or just go to yesmusicpodcast.com and click on the Patreon link. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please do subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.